City of Minnesota House Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee meeting for Tuesday, March 24th, 2026. A quorum is present, and our next order of business on the agenda is the approval of the minutes from Wednesday, March 18th. Representative Reimer, have you had a chance to review the minutes? And if so, would you be willing to offer any corrections if there are any, or move the minutes for adoption?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have had a chance to review the minutes, and I move to approve them.
All right. Representative Reimer moves to approve the minutes from March 18th. Any other corrections? Seeing none, hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. Our next order of business is Representative Gilman, and she is not. Oh, there she is. There she is. She's hiding. Oh, you're on deck, Gilman. I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
Hewitt. No, no, oh. Hewitt. There we go. It's my first day. It's my first day chairing a committee this week.
Congratulations,
Representative Hewitt. Back for the third and final time. Let's hope is House File 2400, the appraisal bill that we had heard earlier this year and laid over, and it has to do with a voluntary disciplinary matrix. And I understand that you have an author's amendment. I will move House File 2400 before the committee to be recommended to go to the General Register. And with that, Representative Hewitt, we will let you talk about your amendment, and we'll get the bill in the order you wish it to be.
Thank you, Tara O'Driscoll. And I don't see the department here, but I can just explain it real simply. As it says in most of our notes, that this is something the department and the appraisers had to work out. Hopefully, this is the last time we learn about appraisals. I mean, it's so interesting. And Chair O'Driscoll and I are really all about this in our real estate world. But the truth is that let's free the appraisers and get them off to the floor. It's a simple check. It gets the department in line to an agreement that gives them voluntary discipline actions here if something goes wrong. And it basically gets us, hopefully, to a state of peace here, Mr. Chair.
All right. That is the A1. It gets us to a spot that seems to be workable for everyone. Members, questions on the A1? If not, we will get the bill in the order that the author likes. So Representative Hewitt moves the A1 to House File 2400. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Hewitt, the bill is in the form that you would like, and I kind of think that with your amendment, you explained what the bill now does. So,
Mr. Chair, I did, and I think it's a great bill. Please, let's free the appraisal bill.
All right. For the record, does the department want to speak to the amendment? I saw Mr. Smith walking in from the department. Would you like to speak to the amendment, to the bill as amended? Please, thank you, Mr. Smith. Good morning, sir. Welcome to the committee. You'll state your name for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Chair O'Driscoll, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to the bill today. The department worked with Byron and other members of the appraisal community and were able to reach an agreement that has the department currently neutral in this proposal. So no concerns with it advancing as is.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. And with that, no member questions. Then I will renew the motion to move House File 2400 to the General Register as amended. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you. Thank you for sticking with it, Representative Hewitt. We got her done.
Thank
now,
you,
House Chair. File 1724, Representative Gilman. And Representative Gilman, I will move House File 1724 before the committee with the intention to move it to the Committee on Health. Welcome to the committee, Representative Gilman, and your bill is before the committee. Again, recommended to move to the Committee on Health. You will go ahead and explain your bill to us, and then we'll take your testifiers.
Wonderful. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for having me. This amazing committee this morning. Great to see you all. So House File 1724 clarifies that direct primary care is not insurance. It's a simple, direct agreement between a patient and their doctor. It creates a safe harbor so providers aren't mistakenly regulated under insurance laws. It protects access to affordable care with transparent flat monthly pricing. Makes life more affordable for Minnesotans is what it does. It gives patients more choice and control over their health care. Supports small and independent clinics by removing costly regulatory uncertainty. Encourages preventative care, reducing long-term health care costs. Aligns Minnesota with other states that have already passed similar protections. House File 1724 ensures innovative, affordable care, and it isn't regulated out of existence. So protecting DPC in statute is the safe harbor bill that protects the practice even if administrations change.
Representative Gilman, I see there's an amendment, an A1 amendment. Is that an author's amendment?
Yes.
All right. Is it your wishes that I move the amendment to get the bill in the shape that
yes,
you like
Mr.
it?
Chair.
Okay. I will move the A1 amendment to House File 1724 to get the bill in the shape that the author wishes. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Seeing none and hearing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author wishes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Gilman, the file is ahead of, in front of us, I should say, 1724 recommended to go to the Committee on Health, and it is before us in the form you would like. Your testifiers this morning. Good morning and welcome to the committee. So state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rihanna Lee. I'm the Legislative and Coalitions Director for the Americans for Prosperity chapter here in Minnesota. And I want to sincerely thank Representative Gilman for being such a champion of empowering patients and this form of affordable health care to make sure that Minnesota is a friendly, safe harbor for direct primary care agreements. Simply put, this bill creates a safe harbor by specifying that direct primary care is not insurance, and that clarity really matters because without it, DPC providers risk being pulled in complex insurance regulations that they were never designed to meet, that jeopardizes a model that is currently working for providers and patients. And both of us have spoken with a lot of providers that have just quite frankly left the system because they recognize that it is broken and it is not working. And so there is a lot of enthusiasm for this model of healthcare. And I will be clear that DPC is not a silver bullet to the healthcare crisis that we have. It is not a replacement for comprehensive insurance, but it is an affordable option that is flexible for those who need it. And this House File 1724 ensures that this kind of model can grow and thrive by removing any unnecessary regulatory uncertainty, and it provides innovative care. I also will defer to my colleague who is also on Zoom who is able to answer any specific questions. AFP has worked. Healthcare is a very important topic for us. We believe in empowering patients over systems, and we want to make sure that healthcare and doctors and providers can meet patients where they need them in their communities. So he is available if you have any specific questions on this model, how it works in other states, and things of that nature. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. I don't know that we, I know that, I believe it's Mr. Clancy is on Zoom. Let's go to Mr. Clancy and see if he would like to share any thoughts on the matter before the committee. Mr. Clancy, are you there this morning?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. If you would state your name for the record and then add anything to Ms. Lee's presentation that you think we should know that she was referring to.
I'm Dean Clancy, Senior Health Policy Fellow at Americans for Prosperity. And to add to Ms. Lee's testimony, AFP strongly supports direct primary care because it gives people reliable, hassle-free health care they can afford. It's growing. There are thousands of DPC arrangements all over the country and in Minnesota. And it's been shown that folks on DPC spend less out of pocket, use the emergency room less, and have better health outcomes. Patients and doctors are happy with DPC. The doctor spends four times as much time with the patient as in the case of a traditional insurance-based doctor on average. So for those reasons, we think it's good for Minnesota. We support the bill and the amendment, and we would love to see it pass.
Thank you, Mr. Clancy. Our next testifier this morning is Sam Smith from the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and then on deck will be Dr. Ejaha Musi. Once again, welcome to the committee, Mr. Smith. You'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chairs O'Driscoll and Keogle, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm here to testify on House File 1724 on behalf of the Department of Commerce. The department shares an interest in exploring innovative solutions to make it easier for Minnesotans to access primary care. From recent stakeholder engagement work on this topic, the foremost barriers to receiving primary care are high out-of-pocket costs, provider supply, and availability. Direct primary care and direct primary care-like approaches have emerged in part to help address these barriers, and the department is supportive of these concepts as potential solutions. However, the department has concerns with explicitly carving out direct primary care arrangements out of insurance regulation, given the important need for consumer protection within these arrangements. The department does not currently regulate standalone primary care arrangements, but codifying direct primary care into statute and excluding it from insurance regulation could inadvertently limit or complicate potential innovative opportunities in this space. We also have general consumer and market protection concerns, including patient selection issues and the potential for consumer harm if the arrangements are being inappropriately represented as an alternative to comprehensive health insurance. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. And again, Dr. Ejaha Musi. There we go. And then after the doctor will be Thompson and drink meal. Bye. Sorry about that. We'll be right after the doctor. Good morning, doctor, and welcome to the committee. So state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Dr. Ejaha Musi, and I am testifying today on behalf of the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians, which represents more than 3,100 family physicians, residents, medical students who provide care in communities across our state. I practice at Frontier Primary Care here in St. Paul. MAFP appreciates the opportunity to express our support for House File 1724. Family physicians are the front door to Minnesota's healthcare system. We provide comprehensive care for patients of all ages, from newborns to seniors. However, primary care practices are facing increasing administrative burden, workforce shortages, and financial pressures that make it harder to maintain access for patients. House File 1724 provides important clarity around direct primary care or DPC agreements. These arrangements allow patients to pay a predictable monthly fee for a defined set of primary care services while allowing physicians to reduce the administrative burden and complexity associated with insurance billing. For patients, this can be better access to care, including same-day or next-day appointments, longer visits, and easier communication with their physician. For physicians, it can mean more time focused on patient care and less time on paperwork. One of my very first patients at Frontier Primary Care, whom I'll call Nancy to protect her privacy, highlighted the financial burdens of conventional health care. A 29-year-old earning a minimum wage without health insurance, Nancy frequently required emergency room visits for recurrent ear infections, resulting in hearing loss. These visits had created significant personal debt for her. By enrolling at Frontier Primary Care, Nancy gained access to comprehensive primary care for a fixed monthly subscription of $80. Shortly before a weekend shift, she used our direct clinic line to report acute ear symptoms. Within hours, she was evaluated at the clinic, received a prescription for antibiotics and ear drops, and was able to work her scheduled shift without needing to call in sick. Later, Nancy faced job loss and financial difficulty. She requested a temporary suspension of her membership payments until she regained financial stability. Utilizing the professional autonomy inherent to the DPC model, I waived her monthly fee until her financial situation improved. This patient-centric care in, This flexibility and professional autonomy is crucial as they allow for clinical decisions that prioritize patient-centered care and actively promote health equity. Direct primary care will not be the model for every clinic or every patient. However, we believe it should remain a viable option within Minnesota's healthcare system, particularly as we look for innovative ways to preserve and strengthen access to primary care. House File 1724 provides a framework that supports patient choice while allowing family physicians to explore new models of delivering care. We appreciate the language clarifying that DPC is not insurance. This is an important step to being able to utilize DPC services in Minnesota. A group of physicians who would like to practice in DPC, though, have expressed recommendations to the author to cut back on some of the provisions that we see as overregulation on the practice of DPC while helping physicians and patients to have the choices that will protect patient access to this type of care. We look forward to working with Representative Gilman to address these issues as the bill moves forward and appreciate her openness to these conversations. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we respectfully ask for your support of House File 1724. Thank you.
Doctor, thank you. We're going to have you stay right there because we do have a member question. Representative Smith would like to ask you a question this morning. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Doctor, for coming and testifying. One of my questions with the direct primary care model, I imagine most folks who are using this service also have some other kind of insurance, probably a high deductible plan, which is why they choose this model. So I wanted to ask from a physician side, and then if someone is testifying from the insurance industry also would like their answer to this, how does your model fit into the sort of insurance matrix? I'm mainly thinking, have there been difficulties with, for example, you see someone and you recommend them to a specialist, you know, you see something and you refer them to a dermatologist with insurance plans not recognizing this sort of care before authorizing other coverage for one of your patients. I'm curious how this care, not from your perspective, but from like the overall insurance matrix, works within that. You mentioned paperwork, you mentioned the various difficulties folks sometimes have getting things covered. So I wanted to ask from a physician perspective how that's working out.
Very good question. Thank you,
Doctor,
for that.
Go ahead.
To answer your question, typically high deductible health plans will have certain costs associated with coming to the primary care doctor, co-pays, co-insurance, and certain other costs associated with getting acute care, for example. Now, typically, if a patient comes in to see us and they're established paying that monthly subscription fee, we can refer to other specialists, and the patient can use their insurance for the specialist. There has been no difficulty in referring patients to insurance-based specialists. Now, sometimes if a patient does not have insurance, that can become an issue. In that instance, we oftentimes will refer to direct specialists, direct pay specialists. They're called direct specialty care providers. They're also growing similar to direct primary care, where a psychiatrist, for example, will take a patient with cash pay models. So there has been very little difficulty in getting patients to see specialists. Now, the other aspect, too, is that recently there's been a federal IRS regulation that's changed impacting HSA eligible healthcare spending with respect to direct primary care, so patients can use their HSA funds for direct primary care monthly membership fee as well. So that also will help with the burden of paying out-of-pocket costs in addition to their monthly premiums for insurance.
Thank you. All right. Our next question comes from Representative Faulkner.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Thank you for bringing this bill. I'm just curious of this model. I mean, to be honest, before this, I haven't really heard of it too much, so this is a great learning opportunity. But I guess, does this have any impact for the availability for home-based care, or are patients still required to go into a medical center or anything like that, just for elderly or people that just find it difficult to make it to a hospital or a clinic setting?
Very good. Very good question. Thank you for that. This actually makes it easier for patients to receive home-based or house calls, for example, back to the way medicine used to be. For example, in my practice, I have many homebound seniors who are unable to make it to clinic, and I am able to make house calls for them, particularly on weekends and after hours. And most recently, as we all know, with the recent surge in ICE agents, many patients who are undocumented have been unable to come to clinic, and several of my colleagues here in the room were able to organize and actually provide home-based care to those patients who are unable to come to clinic.
Thank you. Representative Faulkner, follow up. Okay, Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Gilman, for bringing this bill forward. I think it's an important conversation for us to have. We know that primary care can be really challenging to find, and we know that primary care physicians are, folks who are studying to be physicians don't always choose to go into primary care because it's not necessarily the most lucrative healthcare practice, but it is very necessary. I am, in that same vein, I'm a little bit concerned about how this may impact the availability of care for patients who already pay out of pocket for a traditional insurance model. And I know that it does say toward the end of the bill, line 618, that other care isn't prohibited. So these physicians, even if they're direct pay, they could still take insurance-based clients. But I'm wondering what that looks like. If they fill up with direct pay, if practices choose to switch over to this model instead of an insurance-based model, then are we going to have patients who are paying out of pocket either, you know, for their share of an employer-based plan and then have additional fees on top of that to make sure that they can access primary care in a timely manner if this is a shift in the industry?
Doctor, are you able to answer that question this morning? Representative Gilman?
Okay, thank you so much for that question. Thank you, Chair. I would love to just speak to that really quick. I've been using this model in our business. We've provided this blue collar workers love this because we can also attribute to folks' insurance plan at our company, but then we've also on top of it provided it's called Nice Healthcare. And we will be hearing from a testifier about that. It is incredible. 2 weeks ago, I got the crud that's been going around. So instead of me leaving here, I've got incredible insurance through the state, and I was blessed because the person came right to the office, made sure I didn't have bronchitis or pneumonia, and made sure I was not going to be spreading whatever I had going on. And it makes life more affordable because I didn't have to leave work. They come right to you, and it's just been an incredible model. And our staff loves it. It's helped people get things that they didn't have time for at the doctor to address. So they, two of our employees found out they had diabetes. They did not know that all their other complications were this. So what I love about it is, again, this is just ensuring we have direct primary care. It's an incredible option for people, but we invested. And our insurance guy that came to our office not only sells us insurance, but he offered this solution. And so many of the businesses in my community are doing this for their employees. They'll go right to the school to see the kid as long as a parent's with. It's been amazing. So, yeah.
A quick follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize. I didn't realize that we had still more testifiers, so I'm looking forward to hearing additional testimony. So I hadn't thought through that employers could provide this on top of a normal health insurance plan. So I think that that's a great benefit to folks whose companies are able to add that on. Do you have, just from your professional experience outside the legislature, what can you give us a ballpark of like what the monthly or annual fee typically is it in as a flat fee? Perhaps the doctor could answer that.
I don't know. Representative Gilman or the doctor?
I can take it.
Doctor, go
yes,
ahead.
Yes, it's typically a fixed monthly fee, mm-hmm. And typically it ranges from anywhere from $50 a month to $150 a month. It really depends on the practice and the type of services they provide. And I will just add on to the employer-based side, small businesses actually benefit significantly from this bill because many times they lose employees as a result of not providing full insurance benefits. And so for them to have access to DPC, direct primary care, is a huge benefit for their employees, and they are able to retain employees better. They miss less work, and so this and saves them a ton of money. So it is a huge plus for employees. And I will just add on to that, again, HSAs, health savings accounts, are helping patients have access to DPC. So it's not so much that they're taking a huge financial burden by adding DPC on top of their monthly employer-based premiums.
All right. Thank you so much. We have one more testifier, Thompson Adarinkami. And if there's anyone from the public who's interested in testifying, we will open up for some short public comment, and then we'll revert back to member questions. Good morning and welcome. If you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, everybody. Thanks for having me here. My name is Thompson Adarinkami, and I'm the co-founder and CEO of NICE Healthcare. I'm a longtime Minnesota resident, graduate and graduate student at the University of Minnesota, healthcare economics professional. I've worked over 25 years in the health insurance industry and in the primary care industry as well. And I want to tell you a few stories about why this bill is so important. The first one starts with my son, who was inspiration for why I started this company 9 years ago. 9 years ago, my son came down with a very aggressive cough and a fever, and we went to the clinic, just like you're supposed to do as a parent. We were on a high deductible plan because I was in graduate school. And to cut the story very short, it took 4 visits to the clinic to get his pneumonia resolved, and it ended up costing us $664. $664 is a lot of money, no matter who you are. When you're in graduate school, it might as well be $1 million. And then you're with your first child, going to the clinic 4 times trying to figure out what's going on. And I asked myself, why isn't healthcare working the way it's supposed to? I was already a healthcare professional, an expert, if you would think, in the health insurance industry, and I couldn't quite figure it out. So I started doing research, and I stumbled upon direct primary care and became a huge advocate and fan of direct primary care, so much so that I started a company to solve this problem. Today, NICE Healthcare is certainly the largest independent primary care practice in the state of Minnesota, and most likely the largest direct primary care practice in the country. We serve over 60,000 members in the state of Minnesota. All of them are getting the direct primary care from employers, large and small. The largest employers in Minnesota to the smallest employers, from St. Cloud and Duluth to Mankato and Winona to Minneapolis to St. Paul, we are serving 60,000 members in the state of Minnesota, and I get stories from these members every day. I remember one story during COVID. A CEO messaged me. He didn't know me. He messaged me on LinkedIn, and he just said, thank you for starting NICE Healthcare, because I don't know what's going on with this pandemic, but because of you guys, my employees and their families can still get healthcare. My employees and their families don't have to worry about how much it costs. I just got a review yesterday. We have over 500 five-star reviews on Google. And by the way, go and check out how many five-star reviews our local health systems have and make a comparison. And one of these reviews said, I was in tears because NICE Healthcare saved my family so much money. Another review said, I didn't know I had pre-diabetes. And because of NICE Healthcare, I could work on my pre-diabetes without having to worry about the costs, without having to worry about the access. And guess what? I'm not pre-diabetic anymore. And these are very common stories that I've heard from my over almost 200,000 members that are accessing my direct primary care practice. And again, I want to reiterate, these 200,000 members across the country, of which 60,000 are here in Minnesota, their employer is paying for this. Why would an employer pay more for health care when we all know the cost is increasing year over year? Why would they pay for it in Minnesota when we don't have this wonderful bill already established? You know, why would they take that risk? Because it's broken.
I'm going to ask you to kind of wrap up here. We planned about 20 minutes on this bill, and we're already 25, and we have some member questions that are mounting here. So if you want to just share some final comments. It sounds like you've got a great model.
Thank you. I'll pause there.
Okay.
Respectful time.
Okay. Is there anyone from the public who would like to testify on the matter before the committee? Seeing none, our first member question comes from Representative Finke, followed by Representative Hewitt. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. It sounds like a great healthcare access model for people who have the subscription. But the The thing that worries me is that all of the downsides of the subscription-based economy, do they apply to this, right? Like, what happens when people don't pay for their monthly subscription? What percentage of people are paying for the subscription but not using it? I think that there are a lot of problems with subscription models just in general as the younger generations build more and more subscriptions for accessing the things that they care about. And it feels a little bit to me like, you know, this is a really great option for people who can afford a subscription and want to avoid the pitfalls of the healthcare system, which we all know about and talk about often. But a lot of subscription models are actually financial traps for the people who don't actually end up using them, and then they could get, for example, they could break their leg and have to go to the emergency room or whatever and accessing their insurance for this anyways. So I guess I just want to make sure the model isn't setting up another tier of service, right? I was going to say a two-tier service, but we already have like a 40-tier service of healthcare access in this country. So I'd love to hear just a little bit from the bill author or from whomever about why this isn't another subscription that people are going to pay for and end up not using, and then maybe they won't pay for it 1 month, and then they'll lose it, and then they'll think they'll, like, all of the subscription traps feel to me like a threat to this healthcare for folks.
Representative Gilman, can you address that question quickly, please?
Yes, real quick. We all have, like, in this room have subscriptions, like from TV to, you know, there's all kinds of subscriptions. Our entire family, it doesn't matter who lives at your home, at your address, if it's 10 people, if it's 5 people in your family, you're all covered by that $50 to $150. And this is just an option and a choice on top of things. So for my family, this has made life more affordable because we are covered under one subscription. It's not every single individual person in our family has to have that. And that's what's been so beautiful about this bill, and that's why we're excited to have it go to health so we can just continue to work on tweaks. But if there's anything else, I don't know. But we, you know, we have Netflix subscriptions to Hulu to all kinds of things that give us access to things that we desire. So thanks.
Again, we are over time on your bill, Representative, and so we need to make sure that we get you taken care of here. Representative Finke, follow up.
I'm happy to just be very quickly. I appreciate that. I have a Netflix subscription too. I understand how that works. But there is an entire economic exploitation model in the subscriptions that people don't know that they have, that people end up not wanting anymore. There are problems with the subscription model in general that I think we should be conscientious of if we're going to move doctors out of the primary care system into a subscription model. We should be thinking about. Happy to move it to health.
All right. With that, Representative Kegel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Gilman. Thank you for bringing this. I think it's really interesting. I think you're making the case against insurance, the insurance industry in general. My big question to them is, what are you doing? What do you do here? Like, what's the value? Because I think this direct-to-provider model is something that we should take and just apply it to everybody, everything. And then, I don't know, maybe get rid of insurance companies and start up like a one risk pool type thing where people can actually have choices for healthcare. I think this direct primary care service is something that we really ought to look at, because if we want to talk about making care more affordable, we should get the money directly to the providers and not pay these middlemen in the, you know, who are just kind of taking a cut off the top of our money. And so I think this is a really interesting idea. I think, you know, there might be some things that we need to look at as far as consumer protections and things along those lines. But I think that this is really interesting and deserves a little bit more of a look.
All right. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1724 as amended be referred to the Committee on Health. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Gilman, you are on your way. Our next bill is Representative Allen's bill, and this is a bill that we had heard earlier related to residential mortgage financing. There was some work that needed to be done and an amendment to be brought back, and has been kind of the work plan for the committee this year is that we would hear bills get work done on it, get work done in committee, and then move it out. And this is another one of that, one of those work samples. Representative Allen, I will move House File 3437 before the committee. You have a DE amendment. Would you like to explain the DE amendment, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to turn it over to my testifier to explain the amendment a little bit more thoroughly.
Good morning and welcome. State your name for the record and explain the DE for us, if you would.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Zach Eichner. I work at Taft Advisors, the contract lobbyist representing Rocket Mortgage in this case, and wanted to just very quickly thank Mr. Elwood and the rest of the legal aid team for their very, very helpful work in making this DE the what we were intending to do in the first place with this bill, which is allow for some ease of financing for those folks who are trying to invest in residential properties while making sure that we're protecting consumers at the same time. The DE that is before you in the DE1 addresses the concerns, and there is peace in the valley on this bill.
Very good. I will move the DE1 amendment to House File 3437 to get the bill in the form that the author wishes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Allen, to your bill as amended.
All right. Thank you, Chairs O'Driscoll and Cagle, for bringing this bill back up. We had a great discussion last time in the committee on the benefits of this bill that will be there for small investors here in Minnesota. After dropping the DE, this bill reflects the intent of the underlying bill that is essentially makes it easier for small investors to get financing for residential mortgages. These loans that can be better offer better financing terms and longer payment penalty options will stabilize the house market as it incentivizes buyers to avoid flipping these homes. The language in the DE was worked out between our good friends over here at Legal Aid and Rocket Mortgage, and the whole idea is that this is here to be able to ensure the protection of consumers ultimately in the end.
Thank you, Representative Allen. Any very quick and brief comments, Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair and Chair Cagle, I just want to thank Representative Allen and the company for working so collaboratively with us to get it in the shape that we feel is both protective and then fulfills the underlying purpose and intent of the bill. So thank you very much. We really appreciate it.
Very good. Seeing no member questions, Representative Cagle? All right. With that, seeing no questions, Representative Allen, if you want to make a quick closing comment.
We have a lot of work ahead of us still in committee, so I will just get right to the point. Thank you for your support and urge a green vote.
And I will move that House File 3437 as amended be re-referred to the committee on, to the General Register, All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. You are on your way. Our next bill is House File 4333, Representative Davids, relative to supplemental health insurance products being established here in the state of Minnesota. And as Representative Davids is making his way to the testifying table, I will move that House File 4433 be recommended to be re-referred to the General Register after today. Representative Davids, welcome. If you'll go ahead and tell us a little bit about your bill this morning, sir.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll and Chair Cagle. House File 4333 should be familiar to this committee as it passed the omnibus commerce bill last year. Come back for some reason. Now, what does this bill do? This bill allows agents to offer shorter-term long-term care. So think about the long-term care that you can buy. Right now, it's a very tight market. Your health has to be lily white and squeaky clean, very, very expensive. This bill gives people a shorter term of long-term care. Now, why would you want that? As financial planners work with their clients, this can be a part of their portfolio to protect their assets. This can help. This should save the state a lot of money because there'll be fewer people going into spend down. Because this would probably cover about 70%. I don't know the exact number. 70% of long-term care needs for a person. So we'd like to get this passed in law. We are kind of an island here. Wisconsin has this. Iowa has this. Dakotas have this. Our neighboring states all have this except us. And it's a very important financial planning tool. Underwriting is not as stringent. Costs are much, much less. And so I would really appreciate your support on this. I do have one testifier.
Mr. Wright, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Excuse me. My name is Tom Wright, and I'm here on behalf of the National Association of Benefit and Insurance Professionals, speaking on the need and the support of this short-term care insurance plan. These plans are currently available in about 40 states across the country, and so, you know, as Representative Davids mentioned, you know, they're surrounding us, you know, in all of those states. But at its core, you know, this issue is about a growing gap that's, you know, impacting middle-class Americans. And today, you know, nursing home costs can run $120,000 a year, and home and assisted living costs can run into the tens of thousands of dollars. So these are not outlier numbers. You know, this is the reality. And I think that, you know, most middle-class Americans are not, you know, prepared for this. They're not wealthy enough to fund their own care for an extended period, but they're also not eligible for Medicaid. And so they're forced to go through that spend-down process, you know, in order to do that. And typically these benefits, you know, last for up to 12 months, and they do cover all the range of services, including home health care, assisted living, and nursing home care. But, you know, because of the limited duration, the cost and the underwriting are both easier. So for many Americans, you know, this is a good option, you know, for them. And it help, you know, helps protect their savings, you know, during those immediate phases of care. It allows individuals more control over their care, you know, who's helping them, who's, you know, protecting them. And third, it preserves financial stability. And, you know, just as important is the implications to the state. You know, Medicaid is the largest payer for long-term care services across the country. I've been working on the advisory group for Minnesota's Own Your Future, and they recently completed a study that of the projected costs for long-term care services and the increase in expenses driven by the baby boomers. And, you know, this is a tremendous challenge, you know, for the state in those Medicaid funds. You know, I think over time, the broader adoption of these type of plans will help reduce overall Medicare expenditures and ease pressure on state budgets. So our association, NABIP, you know, supports HF 4333. You know, without these new solutions, the pressure on families and state budgets will only continue to grow. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. Is there anyone from the public who'd like to testify on the matter before the committee this morning? House File 4333. Anyone on 4333? Seeing none, member questions for Representative Davids. Representative Katizawatoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Davids, for bringing this proposal forward. I know that you know, this is kind of your professional wheelhouse, and I'm just curious. I don't know a lot about long-term care or you know, this type of coverage, and I'm just curious. Your testifier just mentioned that this could potentially lead to some savings when it comes to public programs, and would this type of insurance cover more services or different services, or is it kind of just the same, but it's just a private program option for folks to purchase if they have the opportunity to do so?
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. This care is, you purchase a policy, this would just be a shorter term here, and if you can't conduct 2 of the 6 activities of daily living, which are eating, toileting, bathing, transference, medication or something else, mm-hmm. the 6 of them. If you can't do 2 of the 6, then after usually a 90-day wait period or 180-day wait period, then this will kick in so much a day to cover the nursing home. So if this policy is covering the nursing home, the state doesn't have to. They still may have to go through a spend down if they're in the nursing home for a much longer time, But where it saves the state is it keeps them off the public assistance programs longer.
Representative Tizotone.
Thank you. So it's a little bit of a stopgap measure. Is that an apt comparison, perhaps?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, you could call it that. And you, like you said, just for full disclosure, this is one of the areas that I work in. And my goal is to make sure that families don't have to go into spend down. They stay off the state coffers, and they preserve assets for their, and we could get, there's a lot of details in there, like qualified plans and so forth. But basically, we're keeping their assets intact, and we're keeping them off state programs.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Very good. Anyone else? Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just kind of curious along the same lines of questioning as Representative Katizawatun, and I just remember, going through the VA and Medicare with my grandparents and, the 100 days that they get in a nursing facility. And so, and I've seen the way that long-term care works with my both my grandpa and my father-in-law, so it's if you can get it, it's great. And so I'm just kind of curious, this could work in tandem with Medicare then?
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Co-Chair Cagle. It's kind of separate from that, because when you have the Medicare, if they've had 3 days in the hospital and you get 100 days for long-term care, that's separate from the qualifications to get on this. So it actually coordinates pretty well. If you have a 90-day wait on your personal long-term care, and you have 100-day coverage on Medicare, it actually works quite well together.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this would be available to people of every age, correct?
Representative Davids.
I believe most companies you could buy at, what, age 25?
Yeah.
Or 25, 30, and then when you get up in your 80s and 90s, it's pretty tough.
Thank you.
Representative Davids, you have said that we worked on this last year. We did. We brought it to conference committee. There was a desire to do it. There were some problems that were identified, and that's why we're back today with a much tighter, cleaner model on here. And I will just tell you that I agree wholeheartedly with this type of product, because what it does is it allows people to be able to leverage their assets, buy this plan, receive benefit from the plan, keep their assets intact, pay for their own care longer, and not put more people in a destitute situation. And you just don't know how many other people are going to be affected by that when household assets get drawn down. So maybe that was your summation that I just gave. I'm not sure. But Representative Davids will give you the final word.
I would just one thing to the two co-chairs here. The department, I believe I got a notice that they're enthusiastically neutral.
We certainly can call Mr. Smith up to testify to that.
If you just nod the head that they're neutral, or they're not opposing it.
I get a nonverbal clue of a thumbs up from Mr. Smith, okay, for the record.
So he is enthusiastically neutral.
Enthusiastically neutral, apparently. Without Representative Davids, any other comments before we move to the vote?
No, I just really appreciate your support. This helps a lot of families. It saves farms, it saves homes, it saves estates for other family members.
With that, I will renew my motion that House File 4333 be recommended to be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. Our next bill on the agenda is House File 4052 from Representative Crecia. And I will move that House File 4052 be re-referred to the General Register. I understand that this is a bill that has been worked on between the telecom companies and others, and this is updating legislation in our statutes. But we will hear more from Representative Crecia to that matter and his testifier. Representative Crecia, welcome to the committee to testify today. House File 4052 is before us with a recommendation to the General Register, but I do see that there is a DE amendment. Is that an author's amendment this morning?
That is, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to move the author's amendment?
I would like to move the DE, please.
Representative Crecia moves the DE1 amendment to House File 4052 to get the bill in the shape that the author wishes. Any questions? Seeing none, hearing none. All those in favor of the amendment to get the bill in the format that the bill author would like, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Crecia, to House File 4052 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just a quick introduction, then I want to turn it over to my testifier. The purpose of House File 4052 is simply to modernize Minnesota's telecommunications statutes, Chapter 237, to reflect today's broadband-driven marketplace. And I'll let Mr. Christensen take it even further than that because he's really the expert here. I just do what he says.
Mr. Christensen, welcome to the committee. We haven't seen you this year, but we did see you last year. It sounds like you've got some peace in the valley using Representative David's copy and patent-righted term around this legislature. So welcome. You'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony on House File 4052 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the community. Good morning. My name is Brent Christensen. I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance. And we're a trade association that represents over 80 independent telephone companies throughout the state of Minnesota. I'm going to, in the interest of brevity, I'm going to skip my written testimony and just tell you how we got here and what we're doing. About 6 months ago, our membership got together and we started going through Chapter 237. And that is the statute that governs landline telephone service. And the last time it was modified was about 40 years ago when we were still a monopoly. 30 years ago last month, the FCC and Congress deregulated or basically allowed for competition in the landline telephone business, and that's the environment we live today. So we went through the statute, and we did it with three lenses. The first lens was, is it technologically obsolete? The statute technologically obsolete. The second lens we used, is it anti-competitive? And the third lens that we used is, does it conform with federal rules and law? And so as we went through that, we struck a bunch of language. We added some language. We did away with things that related to coin-operated payphones that's no longer in use. We changed rules or laws that govern wiretapping, which we can technologically no longer do. That's been replaced with the Communications Act for law enforcement at the federal level. And so we've tried to get this in the shape that it would make more sense today. We packaged all of this up and we reached out to the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission, and we worked with them to fine-tune this to the document that you have in front of you today. So I believe that we've gotten to a place that we've got, to quote Representative Davids, we have our peace in the valley. I want to thank the Department of Commerce for all of their help in reviewing this, and I'd like to thank the Public Utilities Commission for all of their help. We've added some language that things that they would like to see changed in this process, and I think we have a good bill. I will tell you this is the first step. I'm going to be back here next year because there are four rules at the Public Utilities Commission that relate to this, and we need to change this law this year so that we can modernize the rules at the commission. So with that, I'd ask for your support and happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. He was the only testifier that had signed up at this point, but I will ask if there's any members of the public who would like to speak on the matter before the committee. House File 4052 as amended, dealing with telecom in the state of Minnesota. Seeing none and hearing none, member questions? Representative Crescia? Oh, Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just curious, what's the amount of the population using landline currently? Just curious.
Mr. Christensen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cha, that's a very good question, but that number is going down a whole lot. And this only pertains to landline telephone service. If you get your telephone service from a cable provider, it doesn't apply. Wireless carriers doesn't apply. VoIP providers, this just applies to what used to be a monopoly.
Representative Cha. Good. Okay. Any other member questions? Seeing none and hearing none, Representative Crescia will give you the final word. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cha, I believe the last number is there's two. One is Batman, and the other one is there's a cabin up in northern, near northern Canada.
We know what Representative Crescia is going to do when he's done. He's going to have a comedy gallery show.
Members, this is interesting because the very first bill that I presented in front of Commerce was 1066. The interesting thing about that, if you remember the quote, and I believe Mr. Davids, Chair Davids was there, I knew more about the conquest of Norman than I did the telecom communications, and it was a very contentious bill, and if you remember that. So that launched me into learning about the telecoms and getting there. So the fact that we have gotten to this point where we do have true peace in the valley, we have organizations coming together in the agencies, it really is a nice feat, and I think it's a nice capstone bill for the work that the MTA has put on. So, members, I would recommend passing this to the General Register.
All right. Thank you, Representative Crescia, and I will renew my motion that House File 4052, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. Representative Crescia, we will have you stay right where you are at because you have the next bill on the agenda. And, folks, just to put some clarity to process on here, we have about 50 minutes left of committee today. We have about 24 testifiers who are wanting to speak to the matter. We're going to ask testifiers to hold their testimony to 2 minutes so that we can get public input and that the members of the committee can have an opportunity to discuss the bill. What we are going to do with House File 2874 is we are going to lay it over. We are not going to take action on it today, but we are going to lay that bill over. So again, if you are speaking from the public, just remember, when you go over 2 minutes, you are taking time away from someone else who is sitting next to you, patiently waiting as well to provide testimony to the committee for their consideration. We will, and please do not feel it rude if I tell you please wrap up, because I'm trying to keep things going so that the committee can get as much information for their consumption in the remaining 50 minutes that we have from the public as well as group discussion. So with that, Representative Crescia, I move House File again 2847 to be laid over in the committee, and I see that you also have a DE amendment to this as well, if I am correct.
I do, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to move the DE amendment.
All right. Did you, before we move the DE, do you want to explain what the DE does?
Mr. Chair, if I could actually have our nonpartisan walk through the DE,
okay,
that would be more
helpful.
Okay,
then let's do this. Let's get the bill in the order that you want and explain the amendment, because it may answer some folks' questions today because of the change in the DE. So I will move the DE3 amendment to House File 2874 to get the bill in the form that the author wishes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the motion prevails. And with Representative Crescia's suggestion, we will revert to nonpartisan staff, Ms. Pompu, to explain House File 2874 as amended. Ms. Pompu.
Chair and members, a lot of the differences between the DE3 and the underlying bill are stylistic to make it match the reviser's style manual. A substantive provision that I'd like to point out is on page 5, where it limits the applicable fees to $5 for any advance proceeds equal to or less than $75 or $750. For an advance of proceeds greater than $75, but otherwise there's changes throughout.
All right. With that, Representative Crescia, any opening comments this morning before we go to testifiers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my comments will be to House File 2874 as amended. So members, a couple of things as you listen to this testimony. There are currently, when you look at a United Way study, more than 830,000 households living paycheck to paycheck. Many of us have probably been in that situation. I was certainly in that situation early on, and sometimes it still feels like that. Situations occur, things happen. And why I chose to carry this bill, a little known fact, every month my wife and I, we've talked to individuals in our city, and we just simply write out a check. I don't ask what it's for, I don't ask why. We just write it out and we give it to an individual who hands that out, because tires go flat, batteries die, cars have problems, people get behind on rent, damages happen. And what I have found when I was in some of our most dire situations, options matter. Most situations are temporary. And if you are an individual that has a flat tire or a battery that goes dead and you need to get to a job interview, or simply you just need to get to your shift, options matter, and that becomes the most expensive time to access capital that you already have. So we just simply write the check out, don't worry about it. Now, there aren't enough of people that do that. So when you get into a situation, you need to have options. A lot of people rely on overdrafts. They're just going to write a bad check, which can be very, very expensive. This bill is about options and reducing the cost of that capital and accessing money that you already have earned, the earned wage access. So this will impact many, many people, most people that are on hourly, and the benefits are we reduce the reliance on overdraft fees or other predatory situations where it can become very, very expensive. Again, this is just options. We're helping people get through something that was unexpected and can be very difficult in the times that you're living. But eventually, once you get through those, you can often find smoother sailing, and you can start to build up success from that. But we've all been there. It doesn't matter what level of capital you may have in your life. An obstacle is an obstacle, and you have to navigate it. And so that's what I'm putting together here. Members, 10 to 12 states have already done this, and more are moving on to this. And so we're just looking at creating a safe regulatory framework so that those options are safe and that they're not basically held up in a predatory situation. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. Molly Jones is our first testifier. Ms. Jones, welcome to the committee. If you would state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. And Ben Lean is on deck.
For the record, Molly Jones. Good morning, Chair Driscoll, Chair Cagle, and members of the committee. My name is Molly Jones, and I serve as head of public policy at PayActive. We're an employer-integrated earned wage access provider, certified B Corporation, and a public benefit company. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. PayActive has been operating in Minnesota for over a decade. More than 600 Minnesota employers offer PayActive as a workplace benefit, and more than 15,000 Minnesota workers have relied on it. PayActive is contracted by employers to offer this service. We integrate directly into employers' payroll systems, which allows PayActive to calculate exactly how much an employee has earned. The employee can then access these earned wages when they need to, often to manage an unexpected expense. On the next payday, the amount accessed is automatically reconciled through a payroll deduction, just like taxes or benefits. We offer users 5 free ways to access their wages, including free instant options, and 1 paid option for expedited delivery for a fee of $349, and over 1/3 of our users take advantage of those free options. Critically, this model includes guardrails that distinguish it from other short-term liquidity products and payday loans. Workers can only access wages they have already earned based on verified payroll data. There is no interest, late fees and penalties, and no compounding balance. Repayment happens through the payroll process. Providers have no recourse, and users can cancel at any time. There are no credit checks or reporting to credit bureaus, so even workers with low or poor credit can still participate. And importantly, employers can put in place parameters or guardrails they want for this program. These features are why the Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has said in a recent advisory opinion that these EWA programs are not a loan under federal law. There's no extension of credit, just access to money the worker already owns. In Minnesota, this bill requires EWA providers to undergo a rigorous licensure process before operating in the state, which ensures they're abiding by important consumer protections established in the bill.
Ms. Jones, we're going to ask you to maybe take another 15 seconds to wrap,
okay,
please.
I'll just read in a few quotes from our users who are at work, so they can't be here today. When asked what effect would not having access to PayActive have on you, they said, "I don't make enough money to get by. If I didn't have this access, I couldn't survive. Not having access would make me go back to being in debt. I wouldn't be able to pay my bills or have food in my house. I would have overdraft fees if I did not have access to PayActive." Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Kreisha.
Thank you. And just as you hear information, I'm going to give you a couple anchor points. What you just heard there was workforce stability and employee retention. Remember, sometimes when employees have very difficult times, if they don't tell anybody, that can compound, and then it becomes negative reviews and it becomes a bad cycle for them. So think employee retention and workforce stability. That's what these options are about. So thank you.
Mr. Lean is our next testifier, and then we'll have two folks from Zoom, Yazam Ferrari and then Lauren Saunders. Those are our next two on deck. Mr. Lean, welcome to the committee.
Ben, how are you doing?
And we'll have you go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. And if Mr. Lean looks familiar, he was a former member of the Minnesota House. Welcome back.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to be here and the opportunity to discuss House File 2874. My name is Ben Lean, as I mentioned, with Exodus Lending, Northern Minnesota organizer for Exodus out of beautiful Moorhead. And I do want to thank my former colleague, Representative Kreisha, for bringing this bill forward. I've always had a lot of respect for your representative. However, today I do disagree with you on this one.
We'll change that.
Here to testify against House File 2874. At Exodus Lending, we refinance high-cost debts for folks at 0% interest, including debt from payday loan apps. When discussing these apps with our participants, there's no question these are payday loans. It's money today for payment back on the next payday. It's a loan. The industry recovers 97 to 98% of these loans because of their access to people's bank accounts and paychecks. If the expectation were truly that these did not need to be paid back, then the industry would be giving money away, and we know that's not what's happening. Another reason we don't support House File 2874 is because it's a bill written by the industry to serve the industry. This bill will not provide any meaningful consumer protections for the Minnesotans who borrow from these apps, because they'll still be subject to the same high costs they experience today. Another reason we don't support House File 2874 is lastly because we don't feel that the industry. Thank you. We don't feel that the industry should be giving a carve out. Should be given a carve out. This is a bill by the industry for the industry, and again, it's not going to provide the meaningful consumer protections for Minnesotans. These are loans. We already have statutes in law to cover loans, and we need to include earned wage access payday loan apps into these existing state statutes. We do have a couple testifiers from Exodus Lending who would like to share their story, and I know there are a couple letters in your packets. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lean, and we're going to go to our first Zoom testifier, Yasmin Ferrari, followed by our second Zoom testifier, Lauren Saunders, and then our next live in-person will be Mr. Elwood. So with that, let's go to Yasmin Ferrari.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm Yasmin Ferrari.
Please go ahead and state your name for the record, if you would.
Yasmin Ferrari from the Center for Responsible Lending. I'm here today to urge you to vote against HF 2874. This bill creates a carve-out that allows predatory lenders to evade the core protections of Minnesota's strong lending laws. The reforms you all made in 2023 that include a 36% rate cap. Although market is providing early access to accrued wages, these products are functionally payday loans. They're short-term, high-cost advances against a worker's next paycheck that are due on payday. The bill attempts to redefine these transactions as non-credit to evade these reasonable interest rate limits and consumer protections that you all recently enacted. And these regulations are working for Minnesotans. CRL recently co-authored a recent report examining the impact of the 2023 Minnesota payday lending reforms, enacting that strong 36% rate cap on small dollar loans, drawing on focus groups with former payday loan borrowers. And their findings were clear. Borrowers are better off without traditional storefront payday lending. They've demonstrated adaptive strategies to manage their financial struggles, and they overwhelmingly support strong consumer protections like those enacted in 2023 and 2024 and further regulation, so including enforcement against lenders trying to evade state law. This bill would allow a carve-out for that. CRL's research shows that payday loan apps inflict a multitude of harms upon consumers. Repeat borrowing is the norm, not an exception, so borrowers double their usage over the first year from 2 loans per month on average to 4 loans per month on average. And investigations of data in New York have found an average of 100 loans per year. So these are not for one-time use in the way that they're typically used. Immediate reborrowing is common. So 75% of borrowers take out a new
About 20 seconds.
The same day or the next day after repayment. So maybe there's a one-time benefit, but then they're just filling a hole in your paycheck. Overdrafts actually spike after use. Checking account overdrafts on average increased by 56 on average following the initial EWA and payday loan use. And loan stacking is widespread. People are using multiple of these apps with wages pledged to more than one lender. The average costs exceed 300% APR. And these findings are mirrored in Minnesota. There's a fact sheet in your packet that was enclosed in my written testimony where you can see exactly how this is impacting Minnesota consumers. Minnesota should enforce its existing strong laws and reject
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lauren Saunders is our next Zoom testifier, and Mr. Elwood, if you'd make your way to the testifying table. Lauren Saunders, if you'd identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Lauren Saunders at the National Consumer Law Center, and I thank you for the chance to testify in opposition to HF 2874. The bill declares that loans are not loans, despite the fact that 10 out of 10 courts so far have found that payday loan apps like EarnIn are making loans. bill's so-called protections are meaningless and obscure the core goal of creating a gaping loophole in Minnesota's 36% rate cap. Data increasingly show that these apps exploit and worsen the affordability crisis. 90% of loans have fees. Apps make free options slow, inconvenient, and difficult to access. Consumers pay hundreds of dollars a year in fees. Daily pay extracts over $300 per year on average, and one worker paid almost $1,400 on 450 loans over 2 years. Apps are not free money, and they are not used for occasional expenses, but instead drive a vicious cycle of reborrowing and multiplying fees. 80% of Daily Pay's recent revenue comes from workers with over 100 loans per year. That's from New York data. And nearly half are paid by workers who, on average, take out a loan every other day. I reviewed a video of the Earnin app, and to get an advance without a tip, a user had to make 13 additional clicks and suffer through 17 messages about why they needed to tip. MoneyLion advertises $500 in credit, but limits loans to $100 and allows multiple loans a day, so people have to take out back-to-back loans with separate fees. The New York Attorney General found nearly 2 million loans made within minutes of each other. App users.
Ms. Saunders, about 30 seconds.
Increase use of payday loans and loan stacking. The bill's $5 to $7.50 cap on expedite fees is meaningless when tips, subscription fees, and other costs are not capped, and apps can push people into multiple loans a day and hundreds a year. The only way to prevent exploding fees is through an APR cap like Minnesota already has, or a full monthly cost cap such as $10 a month. Thank you, and I urge you to vote no on HF 2874.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Elwood is next, and then Sarah Doctory from the Attorney General's Office. Mr. Elwood, welcome back to the committee this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Cagle. At the risk of using up all my time, before I begin, I just want to thank Representative Kreisha and his final go-round here at the legislature. He has always been gracious and respectful to me and legal aid throughout his tenure, and I want to wish him the best of luck in his post-legislative life. And with all due respect,
I'm not dead.
I didn't realize that that's what happens when you leave the legislature. I guess that's why everybody keeps running. So with all due respect to Representative Kreisha, I am here to testify against House File 2874. This is just an effort to evade regulation under Minnesota's existing payday lending laws. The problems with this bill warrant a treatise, but since I only have a minute, I'll make a couple of points. First, one flavor of the payday lenders is a product that demands a tip instead of a fee, rather than calling it a fee or interest. Asking for a tip for a loan, as one legislator in another state said, is like going to a bank for a loan and then they ask me for a tip for great service. This just doesn't pass the laugh test. This delete all doesn't solve the fatal flaws of these EWA payday loans. The lifeblood of all payday lending is serial borrowing. We should not sanction a product that offers a shovel to those financially fragile Minnesotans to help them dig a hole further into their finances. This bill has more holes than Swiss cheese. Legal Aid urges the committee not to be swayed by the misleading and inaccurate rhetoric of the industry designed to place a veil over the fact that this product is a payday loan, nothing more, nothing less. You know, there's an old saying, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. Well, an EWA payday loan is not just like a duck, it is a duck, and it should be regulated under Minnesota's existing payday lending law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood, or Pastor Elwood, for the eulogy this morning, or pre-eulogy. Our next testifier is Sarah Doctory from the Attorney General's Office. Welcome, and state your name for the record, and proceed with your testimony, if you would.
Thank you, Chair Driscoll, Chair Cagle, Representative Kreisha, and members of the committee. Sarah Doctory, Assistant Attorney General. Minnesota Statutes Section 8.32 requires the Attorney General to make recommendations to the legislature for statutory needs that exist and adequately protecting the consumer. I appear in my capacity as an Assistant Attorney General in the Consumer Protection Division today to recommend against passage of the proposed legislation, House File 2874. Because this legislation would undermine existing laws that protect Minnesota consumers from predatory small and short-term loans. Minnesota's robust payday lending laws, Minnesota Statutes 4760 and 47601, recognize that short-term small-dollar loans pose higher risks of exploitative practices, in large part given the immediacy of many borrowers' needs. The proposed legislation would weaken those laws. An example to illustrate the impact here. Currently, a $25 advance with a $5 fee due in a week would not be permitted under Minnesota law. The APR of such a loan is over 1,000%, a rate prohibited by statute. But such a product is not uncommon in the earned wage advance industry, which typically does not even disclose the APR to allow borrowers to easily compare earned wage advance products to existing alternatives. The proposed legislation would allow this kind of a product, and it would eliminate other statutory requirements for short-term and small-dollar loans in this context, requirements that are intended to and designed to protect consumers. So, among other things, current payday lending laws, depending on the type of loan, require disclosures about the cost of credit. They require registration and/or licensure by lenders. And they impose limits on the lender's ability.
Is Dr. Harrible, another 30 seconds here?
Thank you. On the lender's ability to force borrowers to contract away legal rights. The proposed legislation would eliminate all of these protections solely for these earned wage advance products. Accordingly, the Office of the Minnesota Attorney General recommends against passage of the legislation.
Thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier is Laura Sales, followed by Kashmir Hogbauer. Born, excuse me.
Chair Driscoll? No, she's
right. Oh, okay. Neither one.
I don't know about Kashmir.
Okay. So Laura's not here. Laura is here. Oh, very good. We'll go to the next testifier then. Kashmir Hogborn. There you are. Welcome.
Let's see here.
So go ahead and say your name for the record.
My name is Kashmir Hogborn, for the record.
Ready for the chair. Okay. Proceed, sir. Yep.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee. Thank you for having me. Again, my name is Kashmir Hogborn. I'm a participant with Exodus Lending, and I wrote a few things. Number one, I do not agree with House File 2874, and I have a few reasons for that. Let's see here. For starters, with me being a participant, I've learned a lot of what happens in the industry on multiple levels. And then as a participant with Exodus Lending, I've also learned a lot of the positives and things that they're combating, which is a lot of the things that we've heard here on how predatory lending, what it is, and how it operates. With that said, let's see here. Number one, the practices that are currently happening, they're too expensive. We've heard some testimony from a lot of other folks, and I'll talk a little bit about why they're too expensive. Number one, the cap on interest rates, as we've heard time and time again today. Understand people sometimes do things when they feel like they're in need for funds and things like that. Expenses and things do come up. And sometimes it feels like we have a lot of crappy options, and we're picking a crappy option out of crappy options. And the thing with this, as we've heard, perhaps it appears like this service or that type of service is helpful temporarily, but that does have long-term impacts. And some of those long-term impacts include
about 30 seconds.
That's all I need. Folks being in check systems, folks having the inability to open checking accounts for their family, checking savings accounts negatively, number one, affecting credit, the ability to procure better credit, affecting individuals and their families. If it's awesome and it helps, that's great. But if it without restrictions, things are not going to be great in the long term. And again, Exodus Lending, they're doing a lot of things to positively combat these negative and predatory practices. So thank you again.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Our next testifier is on Zoom, Garrett Tenkate, and then our next in-person testifier is Anna Odegaard. Is Garrett Tenkate with us this morning?
Hello, yes, I'm here.
Very good. Welcome to the committee. If you would state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, my name is Garrett Tenkate, and I'd like to talk to the chairs and members of the committee about my experience with Exodus Lending as well as with Moneyline. I'm a Minnesotan who takes pride in providing for myself and my family, and that often includes unexpected expenses. At the beginning of January, a seizure left me in a coma and forced me to miss a month of work. That loss of income showed me how fragile, you know, my ability to provide is. I turned to what seemed like an easy fix, an earned wage access app, Moneyline. But what I found there, it was a debt trap. It's a high-cost payday loan. It's disguised as helpful technology, but it preys on us when we're vulnerable. I got trapped in a cycle of borrowing twice my weekly paycheck from Moneyline, paying $50 a week in fees on their loans, and I had to take out loans on what I repaid immediately to repay the rest of it. Those apps can't operate without regulation. So I'm here today to urge you to oppose the legislation before you. What's required is regulation of EWA apps, the same as all payday lenders. They should be subject to that 36% interest rate cap. They should require transparent disclosures. And you can help to protect families like mine and stop the cycle of debt and ensure that when Minnesotan needs a bridge, they don't
serve about 20 seconds left. Load.
All right. Thank you. That's really all I had.
Oh, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I just wanted to give you a little heads up. If there's something else you wanted to add, please feel free.
No, thank you for your
okay.
time.
Thank you. Ms. Odegaard, followed by Sam Smith. Ms. Odegaard, welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chair Cagle and members. My name is Anna Odegaard. I'm the Coalition Director for Minnesotans for Consumer Financial Protection, or MCFP. MCFP advocates for consumer rights for Minnesotans under existing law and pushes for stronger financial protections through policy change. Minnesota's existing fair lending laws protect borrowers from unfair and deceptive practices, including excessive interest and fees, so the Minnesotans can access credit on fair terms. I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 2874, which creates a carve-out from Minnesota's fair lending laws for payday loan apps. Across the country, these payday loan apps have been the subject of many recent public enforcement actions by state attorneys general, the FTC, and the CFPB for engaging in practices that deceive borrowers, trick them into incurring excess fees, and make it difficult to escape an escalating cycle of indebtedness. These companies lure borrowers by advertising loans as interest-free, even though 90% of borrowers pay fees, and the average effective APR of those loans far exceeds the allowable rates under Minnesota's fair lending laws. They advertise instant loans, but don't reveal the high expedite fees they charge for that quick access until the borrower is deep into the sign-up process for the loan. They limit loan size in order to encourage multiple loans, generating additional fees, and they boost their profits even further by collecting so-called tips from borrowers. They extract tips from about three-quarters of users by saturating these apps with what's called dark patterns, which are manipulative user interface designs. These add multiple steps borrowers have to navigate to avoid adding tips, paired with confusing messages to pressure users to tip. The National Consumer Law Center recently published an article illustrating examples of these devious design features called Picking Workers' Pockets. I encourage you to look at it.
Ms. Odegaard, about 30 seconds.
These tricky tactics have generated enormous profits for the fintech companies behind the apps, and those profits come right out of the pockets of low-wage workers. Minnesota should protect borrowers by enforcing fair lending laws equally across all lenders, should not create a carve-out for payday loan apps. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Our next testifier is Mr. Sam Smith, followed by Tara Ryder. Mr. Smith, welcome. If you'll state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Department of Commerce with concerns to House File 2874. When considering the appropriate regulatory framework for earned wage access products, the department would urge members to be mindful of how these products are used in practice. While it is true that some people use EWA on a one-off basis to cover an unexpected car repair or medical expense, data from the Centers on Responsible Lending make it clear that a majority of the transactions are made by users who rely on EWA products on a routine basis. According to CRL analysis of Minnesota transactions, users with at least six advances in one or more months accounted for 33% of all users and 79% of all advances. Roughly one in five took out 25 or more advances in a year. This makes sense. Taking out an EWA loan, which is typically paid back automatically, creates a gap in an upcoming paycheck that requires another loan to fill. Once this cycle is established, the individual must pay the EWA provider to get paid and has introduced new routine expenses into their budgets. With this use case in mind, the fee caps in this legislation are too high. The department also has concerns with language in this bill that stipulates an EWA product is not a loan. If EWA providers were offering users their own money, then repayment would not be necessary and fees would not have to be imposed. The EWA industry has agreed to legislation that defines their product as a loan in other states and should do so here in Minnesota. While there are other issues the department has issues with in this bill, including tipping practices, loan stacking, and I would note there would be department expenses if this were to become law, I will conclude my remarks at this time for the sake of the committee's time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We'll have you stand by in case there are member questions. And again, our final testifier that has signed up in advance is Tara or Tara, I'm not 100% sure. Well, we'll find out shortly. Ryder, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair O'Driscoll, Chair Cagle, and members of the committee. My name is Tara Ryder, and I am the Vice President of Policy and Government Relations for Bridget, which is a financial wellness company that offers direct-to-consumer earned wage access services across the country. Earned wage access, as you have heard, is a small-dollar liquidity solution for consumers to access their earned but unpaid wages before their regularly scheduled paycheck at no cost or for a low voluntary expedited transfer fee. HF 2874 caps these expedited transfer fees for responsible providers in the state and ensures predatory products will not be able to operate any longer with the passage of this legislation. HF 2874 creates a robust regulatory framework to license responsible providers in the state under current lending statutes. The legislation as amended would require clear disclosures on fees for consumers that are not displayed as confusing percentages requiring calculations to determine the true cost of the transaction. California, South Carolina, Nevada, Missouri, Maryland, Wisconsin, Utah, Connecticut, Indiana, and Kansas have all established regulatory and statutory requirements that do not subject the product to APR and other fee structures that have been discussed today. We have data sharing and reporting requirements with regulators for licensing and registration regimes in each of those states. Earned wage access has been distinctly separated by the federal government as payday loans, both under the 2017 Obama administration CFPB and as recently in 2025. Bridget currently serves approximately 75,000 consumers in Minnesota with an average transaction amount of $72. Our earned wage access service is available at no cost to consumers with a low optional $2.99 expedited transfer fee. Bridget only allows one transaction at a time. There is no risk to the consumer. The risk lies with the provider. We would love to work with the legislature on meaningful consumer protections that keep bad actors at bay and allow responsible providers to continue to operate in the state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes the persons who have pre-signed to testify. But again, if there's any member of the public who would like to testify on the matter before the committee, House File 2874 as amended, please identify yourself, and the committee has a few minutes to hear from you as well. Seeing none and hearing none, we'll revert to Representative Kreisha for any final thoughts before we go to member questions, and then we'll go to the final wrap-up before we're done at 10 o'clock. Representative Kreisha, any comments or thoughts you want to share at this point before we go to member questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and mainly just it'll help me. I've been taking notes down. I want to thank all testifiers. So a lot has been said here, and whenever you oppose something, you go to the logical extreme. And you try to position this as something. You've heard it's not a carve-out. No, it's not a carve-out because it's a new regulatory environment. These are not what you're typically classifying as payday loans. Think more of an ATM. Members, if you put a check into the bank, some banks won't even let you have access to that funds for 24 to 36 hours. If you go to an ATM, you're going to pay a fee, depending on the ATM. So when we talk about the fees, and it's great when you take the APR, you take the lowest number with the highest, and you do the division, you can get whatever huge number you want. But if you reverse that, and if you know about fractions, it goes the other way as well. People are very comfortable paying for convenience. ATM fees, a shot of caramel in my high-rise, whatever, that'll be $2.50. So put that into perspective of what you have. Members, a couple of other things to think about with this. We live in a world where electronic transactions have caught up to people at all levels. If you are paycheck to paycheck, as I have been, there are times when I would write a check out and I would say to the person I'm renting from, can you hold this till Friday? On the other side, when I had rental properties, guess what they were doing? People will try every type of trick just to try to make things happen. Can you hold this to Friday? I've had people who don't sign the check and I find out later, yeah, you did that on purpose so I could come. You know, I get it. Members, I've been a CFO for corporations. There, before Check 21 and the presentation of electronic checks, corporations will move money around the country to play the capital game. Okay, so this is nothing new. It's just that Check 21 and immediate transactions has pinched people who are in the toughest, toughest situations. We have to acknowledge that. If your tire goes out and you need to get to work, you need access to options, okay? Members, this ensures that all EWA transactions are non-recourse, prohibits providers from charging interest, late fees, and penalties. It bans credit checks and credit reporting. So if you are on turbulent times and maybe you have a bad credit history because of things that happened, this bans this and still gives you access to that. It creates mandatory disclosures around optional fees. It caps transactional fees. It requires all providers to offer one no-cost option. If you don't need the money right now, you can do this without a cost, okay? So what does this look like? It's a new option. It's access to money you already have. You've earned this. And it's just getting to that you already have. You already own this. So that's why it's called earned wage access, and it doesn't fall in the payday lending. I get it, we're all scared of that. But if you take this away, people go to pawn shops, they get overdraft fees, and they find other things to sell, which is not a good option when you're in a tough situation. I wish more people could simply just find generous places to get out of them. I've been very lucky to have mine, and I've been very lucky to offer those. But I can tell you, when you're sitting with an employee that is going through very difficult times, they just need to get through that, because behind there is a good person. Let's not blame the victim, nor should we limit the victim on trying to get out of difficult situations.
All right, Representative Kreisha, and we're going to go to member questions. Our first member question comes from Representative Finke, followed by Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair O'Driscoll and Representative Kreisha, for your bill. Nobody here is blaming the victims. We are blaming the fintech companies for exploiting people who are struggling. Like you just did a great job of explaining how difficult it can be and how many different games and tricks people have to do in order to make it. I think your final closing is a perfect argument against the bill, because people are resorting to solutions that are not going to be helpful for them, right? You called them games, you called them tricks, people trying to figure out ways. Paying money to get your own money is not a harmless transaction. We keep saying this is money you've already earned, but if I have to pay you money to get the money that I already earned, I'm just paying additional money. That is not a zero-sum transaction. So I actually had a lot I was going to say, but I think that the folks who came here to testify did a perfectly fine job of showing why this is a really terrible idea. Thank you to the Exodus Lending folks for coming. Thank you to the Exodus Lending folks for all that you do for our communities. This is a really bad idea. These companies are making a lot of money. They want to tell you there is no late fees and there's no penalties. It's all like fintech apps don't get created because they don't make a lot of money on the people who are using them. That is exactly what the apps are intended to do, and that's what these ones are doing, and we shouldn't pretend otherwise. Thank you.
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for reviewing this. I was on the bill, then I came off the bill because I heard that this was all about bad lenders and different stuff like that. But then I ran into a case of a person I was helping recently where their overdraft fees went into like $600 that month from the credit union. And then on top of it, they talked to me, and this was somebody in Indiana, actually one of the testifiers brought up that state, and they said, I said, so it looks like you've done some of this prepayment or whatever out of your checkbook. And they said they have. In Indiana, I guess what they do is they allow them to, they don't pay any fees. The only thing they do pay is an expedition fee if they don't need it for 3 days. I'm having trouble seeing why this is a lending area and not a, again, not knowing much about banking and being new to the committee. I'm sure I have a lot to learn, which the staff here told me about when I signed on. I'm just having trouble seeing why. I think this has to be regulated. The other problem here is cash flow. That's what this person's situation was, is cash flow. I've had cash flow issues naturally. And maybe it's time that we work with our employers that anybody under 50K a year maybe has to go to weekly pay or something. I don't know, because I think there's more here, and I hate to put more regulations on businesses because we all hate to do that. But Representative Kreisha, I appreciate you taking this, and I don't want to add to your eulogy here, but it was great working with you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It is Lent. I will come back to life.
All right. Are there any other member questions at this time? Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I pass one of my biggest accomplishments, I think, in my tenure here has been passing that payday lending law. You know, before I was even here at the legislature, I was working on payday lending. Back when I was a, you know, 22-year-old right out of grad school, standing on the corner talking to folks about payday lending with the organization that I worked with. And so I'm a little protective of that law and want to make sure that whatever we do see isn't just payday lending in disguise. Some of the concerns I have with the bill, especially around the tipping, so on page 3.8, there is, you know, options for tipping, gratuity, and other donations. I think that we should not allow that because of the fact that then, you know, like somebody said, they had to click through 13 times not to not have to tip. And so that is something I'm super worried about. And I just really want to make sure that folks who are in these situations, you know, I've had a flat tire, but the last one I had was probably about 6 years ago. So I don't, yeah, right, knock on wood. You know, and so 100 flat tires a year, you know, 100, if you're taking out 100 loans a year, that means that it's not just one crisis. It's a pattern. And so I think, you know, if we really want to address people's living conditions, we need to really address wages. We need to make sure that people have living wages and that they can get a little bit ahead so that if something happens, they don't have to resort to these things. And so I think some of the best things we can do to ensure that folks don't have to resort to these is increase minimum wage and make sure that people have, you know, can make a living. And so I'm glad that we're laying this bill over. I think there's a lot of work to be done on it. But I appreciate the work, so thank you.
Before we go to Representative Kreisha for follow-up, I was wondering if Mr. Elwood could come back. I have a couple questions for him. Welcome back. Mr. Elwood, thank you for coming back. You and I were in my office discussing this bill a little bit and talking about things, and I want you to, for the benefit of the committee, maybe cite two or three other options that someone in a situation similar to what this bill is addressing would be able to go without fee to be able to get money in a short-term environment or in a short-term situation.
Mr. Chair, I feel like I'm
was being summoned to the principal's office, but but thank you for inviting me to share that. Well, first of all, because people may need some short-term cash, does not mean that we should be providing opportunities for exploitive lending. That's not the answer to the problem. The Exodus Lending and the Center for Responsible Lending did a report recently on what people do when payday lending isn't available. First of all, payday lending was not even a thing before 1992. So people somehow managed to make it from paycheck to paycheck without that product. And what they do is what everybody does and what people do all the time. They go to their family, they cut down on expenses, they rebudget, they take a second job. We're in a society now where people work multiple jobs. There's a lot of opportunities. Lyft, for example, being a Lyft driver or Uber driver. People figure out how to make ends meet without digging the hole deeper. And that's what these products do. Because if you take money from away from the next paycheck, then as one of the testifiers pointed out, well, then what do you have to do the next paycheck? You have to take more loans. And that just digs the hole deeper. The answer to this problem is not exploitive lending. What we should be doing as a legislator, or you should be doing as a legislator, and we should be doing as a society, is to figure out to provide responsible credit and help people when they need it, not with these kind of products, but with products that build credit and help people get out of debt and out of the debt trap.
Very quickly, because Co-Chair Kegel would like to comment, I'd like to give the final word here in just a few moments to Representative Crescia. But I was wondering if you could talk to the committee about someone who has their own money in their own bank account and they go to a cash machine and they're charged a fee. How is that different to have access for convenience when you need your money? It's your money compared to a situation like this. They both have fees. You're both going after your own money. So I don't understand yet why this is being demified when you pay a fee. And not that I'm saying that we should have a bill that should prevent banks and credit unions from charging fees to access credit machines. There are some in here who may come back with a bill before the end of session for that topic, but I just wanted to get ahead of it. So if you could just maybe take 30 seconds and comment on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, when you go to an ATM, it actually is your money. And you don't have to pay it back, as opposed to these loans. And the fact of the matter is, this is not their money, as it's been said. It is the lender's money that they're lending you at a fee for a tip. So, I mean, the analogy is completely inappropriate and inapt.
Thank you for your comments. Representative Crescia, my final comment to you is thank goodness that we have the Education Committee, and I know we've been working hard, and you're a co-chair of that. What we really need is more understanding at a younger age about money and how to budget and how to do these kinds of things, and it's not just optional anymore. It's required because there are so many things that are out there. Chair Kegel, we'll come back to you, and then we'll go to Representative Crescia before we lay the bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that I want to mention, and I'm sure a lot of you folks, at least around the metro area, have been seeing mutual aid popping up. And this is something that people are doing not only just as, you know, organic organizing groups, but also there are organizations within the cities that do microloans at no interest. I think I just did a quick Google search, and there's a church, actually, New City Church, that does them for up to $500. Zero interest loans also helps you kind of get back on your feet. And so I think those are the kinds of organizations that we should really be investing in because, you know, when this mutual aid stuff is popping up organically, it obviously means that there's a need for this. And so I think, you know, that mutual aid and microloans is the path that we should be pursuing. And then on the ATMs as well, I don't know the last time I paid an ATM fee is because I just find the ones that belong to my bank. And so I go to the Holiday or go to the drive-through at the bank before I need to get cash. And so, you know, that's pretty easy. And Venmo doesn't charge me anything to, you know, move money around. And so, you know, I think that, again, like Mr. Elwood was saying, you know, we just want to prevent these predatory practices. And so there are different options for folks out there.
Representative Crescia will give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for this discussion of the testifiers. So a couple closing comments. This is not a carve-out because right now there's no regulatory framework, and we're providing that. That needs to happen. The other comment was, well, these are industry folks writing their own rules. Well, when doctors and healthcare people come up and testify on healthcare rules, they're the experts in that as well. So let's just not assume because you're in the industry, you're doing bad things. They're actually trying to set up the right successful framework so that this can go on. The other thing that I would just ask you to think about is, again, this is access to funds they already have. Members get, there are people that get in difficult situations. We can't always find the ATM with our bank, and out-of-bank networks will charge for those. I would ask you to think about this. What is different than going through the drive-through, putting my check in, and then 24 to 48 hours later, I need that money immediately, and I get charged taking it out again? Look at your bank statement, folks. If you're not doing certain amount of transactions, they're dinging you for fees. Moving capital around has a cost. These folks are in tough times, and they have a cost as well, and I'm just looking for options for them.
And with that, I will lay over House File 2874 as amended, and our final order of business, I'm going to take 30 seconds and flip it to Co-Chair Kegel to talk about tomorrow's agenda.
Buckle up for tomorrow. That's all I'm going to say.
All right. With that, no other business before the committee. We are adjourned.